but I'm afraid I show it. Need it, but you already know it. I'm lost, I feel like a replacement. I'm broken, but I don't wanna say.
To the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Sunday night in the Motor City, Detroit, Michigan, USA. Welcome to everybody listening in our immediate broadcast area. Also, all of you listening around the country and around the world. And I still haven't done anything about the opening. The opening sounds like we've been going on for an hour. You're listening, too. It's just, by the way, you start programs, but that's my fault for not getting going on that and changing it, because everybody here at WRF is so supportive, and we could change it easy enough. I just got to get off my duff and do it. How are you doing? I'm just wondering. I'll tell you a story in a second. Let me just do all the nuts and bolts first tell you this is the Night Call Show. My name is Peter Werby. I'm the host. It depends on you calling in at 313-298-WRIF, or I'll give a three-hour speech. I am more than capable of it, so if you don't want to hear my voice only, you call 313-298-WRIF. if you're too far away or kind of shy or something like that. And remember, only about 2 or 3% of audiences call in, because I often meet people and they say, well, I listen to your show, Pete, but, you know, I'm really sorry, I never call in. Well, you're in the vast majority, probably 97, 98% of the people don't. So don't feel bad, but, yeah, do call. It's like anything. Do it the first time, you get a little nervous maybe. What I would suggest is writing things down, a little, you know, little cheat sheet. I have that. I have little notes to myself, what to talk about and what main points to hit. I'm not sure everybody does that, but I do. I've got a website. It somehow, it was at like 360,000 hits, right? And all of a sudden it went to zero. Now it's like 6,500. So I don't know. I don't know what that's all about. Anyways, it's peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. If you want to get in a chat room while this is going on, go to tomhartman.com, log on to his chat room, and then you'll find people chatting about this show. We broadcast tomorrow of it all, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. at radiopower.org. All the times are Eastern in the United States. You know, there's a way to do it. GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, and it's minus and plus. Someone write me. I forgot how that works. Well, if you're in Eastern time, what is it, like 5 plus? What would it be? It's getting minus 5 GMT or something like that. Anyways, all of it is archived at whiterosesociety.org. Now, here's what happened. I almost didn't come. I almost wasn't here. I printed out all my stories, and as usual, have 10 times more than I could ever use on a Sunday night. But I always do that, and I keep telling myself, you're never going to be able to talk about this, Pete. Don't even bother. Don't wait, you know, kill trees and what have you, and you've got too many stories to manipulate and all that, so it just raises your anxiety level. Yeah, I mean, people say I sound so cool on the air. Well, once I get going, I am. But I've got I've got this big round oak table in our dining area, and I got everything laid out there, and I start getting crazy. Should this go in this pile? This, you know, this goes here? No, that'll go over. And so anyway, but that's what I do. So where was? Oh, okay. So I'm all ready to roll, almost, and then I remember I should ice my foot because I have this inflamed tendon on my foot. Just too much pounding, too much walking, too much handball, too much Tai Chi, I guess. But it's okay. You know, I get this ice pack out of our freezer, and I get a towel that's hanging, a little dish towel, because you don't want to, because it's got frost on it, and I want to make my sock wet. I'm going to just kind of put my foot on it while I'm sorting through the stories and marking them up and putting little notes on them and all and what have you. Suddenly, I feel, and so I do that, and suddenly I feel like someone has put a cigarette on my foot. And I go, ah, and out of the towel comes a bee, one of those damn yellow jackets, right? Now, these guys have a vendetta against me. They sting me every single year, and at least now, and I don't know what this portends for the year, because usually they only sting me once a year. About 2 or 3 years ago, 5 of them stung me in the face. When I was on Lake Michigan, stung my wife about 3 times. So what happens, though, as most of you know, the more you get stung, rather than building up a tolerance and a resistance to it, it goes the other way. So last summer, when I got bit on my finger, I just got incredibly flush. My whole hand swelled up, and I got, welts, hives, whatever, all over my body. So as soon as this hit, I went and I took 2 Benadryls, which are like an allergy medicine, but it's also good for this kind of stuff. So I started to get this really weird feeling, both, I think, from the little critter's venom and from having just blasted down 2 Benadryls. So anyways, it all went away, and I guess, I had a couple things. I thought, man, what if I get real sleepy and I can't think? I'm going, wow, yeah, well, this is, what should I, yeah. So I was going to do what Tom from Ann Arbor suggested and just do a whole show of music that essentially says what I say every Sunday. But you're going to just get me yakking as usual. Well, that's my story. Steve from Lincoln Park wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And he said, check out your quote by Voltaire. Now, Voltaire was a 18th century philosopher. French, huh? Typical Werby, a French philosopher. Anyway, he says, I think the quote should be Well, here, I'll read you the quote first, which I think is really important. Anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices. I mean, isn't this perfect for today? Anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices. This is what it's said for, since I went to February of, I can't remember when. Like, it says on my website. Anyways, where, I mean, about 3 years. And I don't know if Bill West is still listening in Seattle, but he put this all together for me. Bill, if you're still listening, hi. Greetings to you. But in any event, Steve from Lincoln Park writes in your Voltaire quote, I think it should be has, not hams. So I look at the thing and it says, anyone who hams the power to make you believe absurdity has the power to make you commit injustices. So I think, why the hell did that happen? Has it been saying hams for the last 3 years? Ever, you know, 350,000 plus people have gone there and it says hams? Anybody else seen that? Thanks a lot, boy. I don't. I'm my own webmaster. I don't have a big staff here. Jay Hudson is my producer, as well as being the producer of Motor City Riffs, which precedes this show. But I take care of all this stuff. I answer all the email. I do the website, and it's pretty hard to keep up with. I mean, I'm not complaining. But for instance, Cody, who's delivers mail at night in the Detroit area, he wrote in and said there was a dead link on the Bush pages, a subpage from my page, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. So I count on you folks. It's going to have, talk about absurdities, it's going to have absurdities up there unless you say, hey, you left out a word, or that's wrong, or it's a dead link. So if you can, you know, if you want to do it, please be, like, what would you say? Proofreader or assistant webmaster or something like that. All right. I thought I would see. Actually, my brain is working all right, even with all the Benadryl in me. So I was going to start on kind of easy subjects and get you really into it. I think this will really ring the phones off the hook. Star Wars, that's right, the brand new movie, Episode 3, Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. And it's a theme of democracy on the skids and a ruler preaching war to preserve the peace. And over in Cannes, where's that? France. There you go again. France, yeah. The audiences made blunt comparisons between Revenge of the Sith and the story of Anakin Skywalker's fall to the dark side and the rise of an emperor through warmongering, and they compared it to President Bush's war on terrorism and the invasion of Iraq. Right. And at one point, Anakin says, if you're not with me, then you're my enemy, echoing Bush's international ultimatum, either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. And there's a couple of other things as well. And one of the moviegoers said, the anti-Bush diatribe is clearly there. Now, there are these right-wingers. But I mean, well, here, let me ask the question, throw it out to you. George Lucas's film, is it an anti-Bush film? I mean, I hope so. I mean, let's hammer this guy from all angles, is what I say. I think the chickens are finally coming to home to roost. This is, remember, my favorite phrase about which is not written by a Frenchman, but by an American. You can fool all the people some of the time. And that happened after September 11th. And now we're back to the point where you can fool some of the people all the time. And those are the people that still support Bush, still think that there was some legitimate reason for attacking Iraq and what have you. Anyway, so if you saw Star Wars, and how would you assess it? Well, the right-wingers, it must be, because the right-wingers are going crazy. And there's a couple of sites where they list people in the media and people in Hollywood that patriotic conservative Americans should boycott. Except what's so ridiculous about it, almost everybody's on there. I mean, the list is endless. And I was going to write these people's out. I was going to say, hey, put me on there. I have, you know, I feel badly. You're not listing me. It would be much simpler for them. I wanted to simplify their life. I mean, I'll give people I don't agree with advice sometimes. And this was, list the people that agree with you. Then they'd have about 4 or 5 rather than 300 or 400. Anyways, well, nobody wants to talk about Star Wars. We'll talk about Bush in Grand Rapids. This was absolutely incredible. after Bush barely squeaked into office, and probably on the basis of another stolen election. If every vote would have been counted in Ohio, if voting machines would have been available to everyone that wanted to vote, Bush, again, would not be in the White House today. But whatever. And so a lot of people in the North, a lot of liberals, a lot of Kerry supporters started saying this is Jesus land. That's what they were calling the United States, that it had become this theocracy, that it was, the views of the Christian right had completely overtaken the country, and that was it. That's what Christianity represented, these far right-wing, hard-line Christian conservatives. And Bush kind of believes that, too, or at least probably whoever tells him that that's the case. So he decided he would go up to Grand Rapids, Michigan, a very conservative area, and speak at Calvin College, a very conservative Christian college. Calvin, very, very conservative theologian, even to the, I mean, more conservative than Martin Luther, for instance, even. And he was a big fan of capitalism, and he actually said that you will know the elect, the fact that God had preordained who was going to be saved. You really couldn't even change that. And there was something about, you shall know the elect by thy works. In other words, it said if you were a good middle class or upper class person, that was proof that you were going to go to heaven and sit at Jesus' knee. So here is the president who only goes in controlled situations. And you know that whole deal where anybody that tries to protest, they won't even let people in. If you have a pin that says, end the war in Iraq, and there's millions of those pins in circulation, you won't get in. I mean, it's not like you're going to do anything or anything, but you won't even get in. So that's a hand-picked audience. Bush figured this was the perfect place. Grand Rapids, Michigan, a commencement address, Calvin College. One thing he didn't count on, though, was the fact that one-third of the faculty members of this conservative Christian college signed a letter of protest that appeared in a half-page ad in the Grand Rapids Press on Saturday, yesterday. And the ad cost these folks $2,600. So a third of the whole school did this. I mean, they always talk about liberal schools. If you tried to do this at Yale or the University of Michigan or something like that, it wouldn't work. You would nowhere get anywhere near a third. These conservatives are totalitarian, right? And they want to totalize their beliefs. So they're always characterizing these universities as these hotbeds of radicalism and Marxism and what have you. Anyways, here's what the ad said from the Calvin College. As Christians, we are called to be peacemakers and to initiate war only as a last resort. That's what the ad says. We believe your administration, George Bush's administration, has launched an unjust and unjustified war in Iraq. So this kind of throws up for grabs a lot of the definitions that people have of Christians, right? They don't all support George Bush lockstep. In fact, I know lots of Christians. I don't know one of them. I mean, Christian activists, Christian people that I'm very aware are Christians. I don't know, come to think of it, I don't know of anybody here at WRI, whether they go to church or not. But the people I know that are very religious and very devout and Christians, they're all anti-Bush. All anti-Bush. Now, more than, and this is a very conservative student body, but more than 800 students, faculty, and alumni also signed another letter that was put in the Grand Rapids paper. This ad cost almost 10 grand, and it said, pardon me, we are alumni, students, faculty, and friends of Calvin College who are deeply troubled that you will be the commencement speaker at Calvin. This is speaking to Bush. In our view, the policies and actions of your administration, both domestically and internationally over the last 4 years, violate many deeply held principles at Calvin College. Elise Stelzinger, 22-year-old Lambertville resident who will graduate Saturday, says, I'm definitely worried about a Christian school being affiliated with the Christian right. So our hats are off to them. And on some of those hats, you know, they're called mortarboards. They had things like no war. I mean, some people had support for Bush as well, and said the students cheered him warmly, but there were demonstrators outside as well. Now, I mean, it's hard to believe that in any country other than one of these miserable dictatorships that Bush still continues to support, like Uzbekistan, that he remains in office after this egregious, at best, error about the invasion of Iraq. And at worst, monumental lie, which I would say that's what it was. But it's come out as well and finally making itself into the mainstream. This is the, we mentioned this last week, the Downing Street memo, where this was a summation of what was by the British government of the Bush intention to go to war. I mean, they had decided they were going to go to war and they were going to overthrow Saddam Hussein. So 4 days before Bush delivered his 2003 State of the Union address presenting the case for war against Iraq, the National Security Council staff put out a call for new intelligence to bolster claims that Saddam Hussein possessed nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The only thing is that the National Intelligence Officer for Strategic and Nuclear Programs told investigators that they believed the nuclear case was weak. And it's been clear that the September report of the Iraq Survey Group, the CIA-sponsored weapons search in Iraq, that they did not find any weapons of mass destruction, and this was the reason. The question of pre-war intelligence is thrust back to the public eye with this memo. It says a close reading of this 600-page report by the President's Commission on Intelligence and the previous report by the Senate panel shows the war as the war approached, many U.S. intelligence analysts were internally questioning almost every major piece of pre-war intelligence about Hussein's alleged weapons program. And there wasn't any. And they knew it. They absolutely knew it. And so the internal mechanism, the intelligence mechanism of the United States of America knew that Bush et al. Were BSing. But yeah, they went along with it. As it stands now, with over 1,600 Americans dead, who knows? I mean, I can't even find anymore how many Americans are wounded. It's probably up around 13,000, up to 100,000 Iraqis dead. And one U.S. officer suggested on Wednesday that American military involvement could last, quote, many years. And so these people that we're trying to help, we're just trying to get them a little democracy over there, right, by killing lots of them. But thousands of Shiites, not the Sunnis, but thousands of Shiites on Thursday, many waving Islam's holy book over their heads, protested the U.S. presence in Iraq on Friday. And so here are the people we're trying to help that are saying, get out. The protest drew about 6,000 demonstrators in three cities. And this is Muqtada, right, al-Sadr said to reject the U.S. occupation of Iraq by painting Israeli and American flags on the ground outside mosques to be stepped on in protest against raids against holy places. So this is, why we're expending our treasury and we're losing our lives and we're killing people for people that are saying, get out. All right, let's see. Oh, this is interesting. Laura Bush, she's there's protests against her in Israel and the Prime Minister of Israel. Sharon is in New York with protests against him. I guess it's fair. What is she doing there? Why is she going to Israel? That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, Laura Bush said today that her husband should have been interrupted on a bicycle ride last week and told that an off-course plane had prompted a frantic evacuation of 30,000 people from the capital. Do you think? Huh? Her comments were the first in public, and she said, well, sure, I mean, I think he should have been interrupted. Well, I mean, I sure, I think, too. Well, sure, right. All right, we could just start. Let's do that. Jay Hudson is waiting for your calls at 313-298-WRIF, and I don't know which call to take first. Jay, you don't have that indicated here, but I will then. Oh, you do indeed now. Thank you very much. This is Jim. Jim's calling from Westland. Hey, Jim, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Pete.
Hi.
Well, first, I'd like to say it's a privilege to be on the air. And I would like to apologize to you and your listeners because I was on the show a couple weeks back. I accidentally let a obscenity slip. I mean,
okay, that's all right. Move on.
I have a couple of points real quick. First, the Star Wars thing. I don't know if the comparison to Vader is really fair because A, Vader is much more evil and yet somehow much more cooler than Bush.
Okay. I haven't seen it, so you can tell me anything.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen episode 3 myself, but then again, I'm waiting for like a week to pass by.
All right, so you say, A, Bush is not as evil as Darth Vader, but B, Darth Vader is much cooler.
Yes.
Okay.
And he also destroyed a planet. Whereas, you know.
Bush hasn't done that yet.
No, not yet.
Right.
He's getting there.
Yeah.
Man, if I could talk to you for like an hour, you know.
Okay.
But
we got about another minute.
Right.
Well, you're taking two big breaths. We're going to let it go that, Jim, and see how other people respond to what you say. Who's cooler, George Bush or Darth Vader? And is Darth Vader more evil than Bush? We'll have to check that out with you guys. Here's Nick from Detroit. Nick, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good. Welcome.
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
I've listened to your show a couple dozen times. God, not very long, because I disagree with you a lot. And I want to be respectful here of you. So, but I think it's funny. And you got a good rhetoric there. You really do. And I am one of those conservatives. I did vote for Bush only because he was a lesser of two evils. But I often think, you know, you could really use your rhetoric to a better degree if you weren't so slanted against Bush.
Well, I always like career advice.
Let me just speak for a second. You got a guy in there right now, and I do agree with you. I think the guy's very inept. I do. But he's moral. And then you got a guy like Clinton who was very, very adept, but was very immoral.
Well,
wait.
You think George W. Bush is moral? He fabricates and scares all of us about the potential of somebody who is actually not. His dealings in business over the years are certainly circumspect, and you can go to my website and you can find, like, I think it's like the 30 Bush scandals. So to say that I don't have any brief for Clinton. I never even voted for him.
Okay,
go ahead.
Let me just say this on your show. People take positions in this country. You're very much the far left. I remember you were ripping on Reagan one day about him having a scandalous administration, and that's your opinion. Clinton's.
Wait. You think Reagan did not have a scandalous administration? There were more people arrested, convicted, and charged with crimes than anybody since the last Republican that got all those problems, you know, Nixon or even back to Harding.
But Reagan wasn't a self-serving politician. He didn't have a Whitewater scam. His wife didn't turn $1,000 into a $100,000 gig on a commodities trade.
Oh, man. I mean, you're talking about this thing that we spent, how much did that all cost the American taxpayer? Like 30 or 60 million? I can't remember. But, you know, these guys are politicians. I mean, Bush has these scams that are worked through his father and his father's friends, and he made this, a lot of money. I mean, his businesses fail, and he winds up making a lot of money. So, and whatever Whitewater was, and there certainly was enough attention paid, and finally, even the Republicans admitted that there was nothing there. So, I mean, come on. Yeah, right. Where's the...
There was nothing there. How about, you know what? Let me just make a point. My original point was this, and I don't want to chew up your time. You know, you get a lot of listeners.
No, I want the advice and what I could do with my rhetoric other than doing what I want to do.
I will give you the advice with your rhetoric. Until people in this country hold both parties to a higher standard, see, you know what the two parties in this country are? They represent a divorce. These are the citizens of the children. One's a mother, one's a father, and they literally spend billions of dollars destroying each other in these elections. All this money funneled into both of them to have their heavy hands doing what they do.
Right.
And we suffer as a result of it. Jobs going overseas. See, you don't benefit from either party being in there.
I agree 100%. But wait, I agree with you completely.
Let me finish with it, Peter. The best thing that could happen is when you have one in the White House and the other two parties in Congress, or vice versa. I will say this on Clinton's behalf. Those were prosperous years. At least we enjoyed some prosperous years because neither one of them could push their agenda down your throat. I at first I was somewhat excited that Bush got in there and he had that they could do what the, you know, first time that all the Republicans had all three offices. And it's just, it's ridiculous what's going on.
Well, I agree with you. I don't think we are so far apart. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I never did get the advice what I could do so well with my rhetoric if I wasn't so slanted, but we'll just have to go with that. Here's Bill in Ann Arbor. Bill, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I was just wondering, you're comparing Bush to Darth Vader.
I didn't. The caller did.
The caller did before. I just, have you ever seen the POT TV network?
The what?
POT TV network.
POT, like in P-O-T?
Yeah, POT as in marijuana.
No.
Oh, well, you should check it out. They have a good show, Burning Shiva, and it connects Bush to, you know, the apocalypse, and it's really interesting. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, thanks a lot. I'm not sure what that all meant, but, you know, who knows. Here's Bob in Mount Clemens. Bob, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Mr. Werby.
Hi. Hey, can you hear the show on hold?
No, I couldn't.
Okay.
That's why my radio was on. I'm sorry. But
yeah, no, there's something wrong. We can't understand what it is. All right, yeah, I'm glad your radio's off because we are on a delay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, first of all, I want to say, usually I'm not up when your show's on, you know, I'm tired and I have to work, so on and so forth the next day. But when I can't stay up, I love your show. I wish it was on during the daytime. I feel kind of forced to listen to the other guy, you know, around noon, you know, because I just like following politics a lot, you know. And
yeah, except the guy is such a twistoid that, you know, unless you know all of the answers cold, you start going, wow, wait a minute, man, wait, I didn't know that. Maybe you start thinking, maybe he's got something there. But he almost never does. It's always, you know, being this multimillionaire himself, he essentially is making excuses for the party that advocates policies that that support multimillionaires like himself. But he knows that, and the Republicans know, that the vast majority of people aren't rich. In fact, very few people are. And so how can you get those people to support the agenda of wealthy people against their own best interests? So then he's got to make up this unending stream of BS and dis and misinformation. And, I mean, I'll tell you, when I listen to him, my mind starts reeling because this is my job. I can answer most of this, but almost everything he says is a lie. I mean, his clauses are a lie. So he says, duh, 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 and you go, that's not true. And then by the time he's finishing this sentence, you're going, well, wait a minute, that's crazy. He's starting from this insane premise and he's putting forth all this misinformation. And then, I can't listen for more than a minute or two.
Funny about it, like me and one of my friends, we talk about it sometimes. Like whenever anyone has a good point, you know, like he's always coming up on a hard break or something, you know, and he's got a, you know, he cuts them short, and then it gives them time to do research, and he cuts people off a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, let me tell you another thing. When you have a big talk show like he does, like sometimes people, I remember, I'm still remembering this. This woman that wrote me from Ann Arbor, a U of M student, and I garbled the first name of Scott Peterson, you know, the guy convicted of killing Lacey Peterson. There, I got it all, because I don't pay any attention to stuff like that. And what happens with full-time, big-time talk shows, which this isn't, you have a number of producers, and immediately on one of the, like, seven screens in front of me, it would have said, Scott, his name is Scott, and then it would have had, like, the whole, you know, like, history of it all. And you're right. Also, all he's doing is reading it off a screen.
Yeah.
You know
what I wanted to really, you know, I really respect you for, and I, you know, I wanted to thank you for, is I was just talking about this to one of my friends, and I really feel that the media, before this Iraqi war, really let us down. We didn't hear any discussion, for the most part, any good discourse, any debate. Everyone was so afraid to oppose the war, including many Democrats, that they were afraid to be labeled as unpatriotic, so on and so forth.
Right.
And I know a lot of people who were really for the war beforehand. And I spoke out against it because I was against it
mm-hmm.
beforehand. And now it's almost too late. You know, it's like Colin Powell said, you know, it's like going into a China shop. If you break it, you own it. You know, now we're in a bad spot, you know.
Well, but, and we sure have broke it, haven't we?
Yeah, we sure have. And you know, but you were always there, and, you know, like I said, everyone was so afraid to even, you know, like, oh, they always had a spin on it. Like, as soon as you said anything against it, oh, you're comforting the enemy, you know? I mean,
well, it's pretty interesting that, well, I mean, a couple papers like the New York Times, Washington Post actually said they had not done enough. But already the bodies have stacked up. The fortunes have been lost. The country of Iraq has turned into rubble. The United States trying to fight an enemy it can't really pin down. Just looking at the story I may read later, kind of from the Vietnam era. What was one? I remember seeing this sign at a Vietnam. I mean, I wasn't there. I mean, I saw a photograph of it that said, "Kill them all and let God sort them out."
Listening to WRIF.com.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Boss Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock. The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Hey, welcome back. This is the Night Call Show. Peter Werby here with you at 313-298-WRIF. And what are we talking about? I mean, somebody called in and said that George Lucas's comparison of Darth Vader and George Bush wasn't apt. Two reasons. One, he said that Darth Vader was more evil than George Bush, but that Darth Vader was cooler. I don't know. Lots of other stuff, too. Probably at about midnight, we're going to be talking about something positive. People always think, gee, Pete, all you ever do is talk about negative stuff. I'm going to solve the world's problems. So it won't be just crapping about Bush and what he's doing to the economy and what's doing to our country and what he's doing overseas. But I'll give you some positive stuff on it. All right, well, let's go back to our phones now. And I'm going to grab Scott from Westland. Scott, hi, it's Peter. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Pete. This is Scott from Westland. Well, I guess in publishing, this is what they call errata, you know, that basically, I guess
error.
I did make a mistake. Yeah, errors, you know, last time, that's errors in Latin, I guess. You know, when I was on last time, I guess I was under the mistaken impression that when you turn 65, you began to get your Social Security benefits automatically. But in point of fact, the system as it exists now is voluntary. You do have to apply for them. And it's funny because both my parents are on Social Security, and, you know, I actually, you know, practice my rap on them sometimes. And I ran that, you know, by them, you know, and they didn't pick up on it, I guess, because they both retired early at 62.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they didn't, they had, you definitely have to apply if you want to, you know, get it early.
Well, you do have to apply. You have to apply in any regard. And also, nobody gets it at 65 anymore. It goes up by 6 months. I don't know how old, like if you're 25 or 35, you're not going to get it when you're 65. You're going to get it when you're 65 and 6 months, or maybe even more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, now here's an interesting anecdote that I stumbled upon, and I only heard this from one source. Maybe you can confirm this. That some of these studies that say that, you know, the Social Security system is going to start running out of money in the middle of the next century arrive at this conclusion by extrapolating the average life expectancy based on the past rate of increase. So according to these studies, one of the reasons why Social Security will be running out of money in, let's say, 2050 is because people are going to be living to be 150 years old.
Well, they don't have to live to be 150. If the average age, if the mortality rate, I guess that's not the way, if the people lived longer, even 2 and 3 years longer on average, it does strain the system. I mean, right now, you're right, somewhere time between 2042 and 2052, depending on whose figures you look at, that if nothing at all is done, you could have, we might only be able to pay our seniors 3/4 of the benefits that we currently have. But we don't have to do anything now. I mean, we could do it in 10 years, we could do it in 20 years, because it's not a monumental problem. This is just another case where Bush is trying to frighten people for a particular agenda. I mean, he wants to destroy Social Security, you know, or turn it all in, well, essentially would destroy it, privatize all these accounts and turn it over to his Wall Street buddies who would get all these fees. And as it is, he's beginning to talk about diminished benefits for the middle class and the working class. The only people, he says, that wouldn't be touched would be the poor, and he says that now. Well, what we should be talking about is increasing Social Security benefits without any greater taxation on either the middle class or the working class, who are taxed enough. The people that aren't taxed enough are the people that just got these gigantic tax breaks from Bush, the ultra-wealthy. They can pay. See, if you and I, if middle class and working class people pay 3% more, that hurts. That's a bite, because things cost so much, people's wages are actually slipping. But if somebody in the top 5% or 1%, if they have to pay a larger share of their taxes, they're not even going to, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe they can't buy another island, or they'll have to settle for an apartment that costs $3 million rather than $3,700,000. So that's who should pay it. We have to have a tax raise, but not to 90% of the American population. All right, thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate all the clarification. Let's go right to Kevin, who's in Taylor. Kevin, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Yeah, my name's Kevin. I'm in Taylor here, and I wanted to call up on the Star Wars issue.
Sure.
A lot of people are saying, you know, trying to compare this to what's going on with the war in Iraq and all that. And a couple of big differences. I've actually haven't heard anyone else with this story, but I'm, you know, what's your traditional Star Wars geek.
Okay.
And so, as in my opinion, I don't see any way to, you know, possibly do that, considering the fact that, first off, George Lucas wrote all this stuff. The basic plot lines were all set up, you know, back in 1974 and 75 when he wrote the original episodes. It's the story of Anakin Skywalker and his turn to the dark side through, mm-hmm. you know, right. circumstances. So that's the big part of it. But what I personally see, if anything, I could say it looks more to be like comparing it to Hitler. And actually not with Darth Vader, but with, you know, the Emperor, Chancellor Palpatine, to where, you know, he is going in there and turning everyone against, you know, saying, you know, it's the Jedi, they're our problems. And then, you know, we have to take them out and take care of. And that's ultimately what this, you know, definitely, if it compares to any real-world events, that's what I would definitely lean toward.
Are you at all willing to take up the question of who's cooler, as our caller said, Darth Vader or George Bush?
I'll tell you, I'm a right-wing conservative. I love George W. Bush, but I will say that Darth Vader's cooler. I'm a Star Wars geek at heart.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We've had a little problem with our spots. We're going to have to take a few more spot breaks, so we'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening, or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
RiffRock.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. You know, it's just extraordinary. You have these conservatives that aren't wealthy. I mean, they are just water boys for the rich and just sort of fueled by rage and resentment. And, man, are we getting them tonight? Here, listen to this guy. I mean, he's got, some of the stuff he's talking about is actually worth discussing. I mean, he says, you wouldn't want me on your show. I tear your lies to shreds. Russ from Temperance, Michigan. A nuclear chemist. Now, there is a job that should not even exist. If all forms of nuclear energy and certainly weapons ought to be out of here, and Russ could, Russ, some worthwhile job, that's for sure. But, hey, Russ, give me a call and see if you can tear my lies to shreds. You know, in fact, he doesn't even talk about lies. And he's one of these guys, actually, I mean, I don't want to read this whole thing, but, he's saying it's not 100,000 dead Iraqis, it's only 22,000. Oh, okay, yeah. Sorry about that. Here, and well, here, this is for him. From Knight Ritter Services, this is who owns the Free Press. A Marine-led campaign killed friends and foes, Iraqi leaders say. When foreign foil, this talks about this whole deal where when the, this, what was it called? Matador, Operation Matador. The U.S. military hails it as a success that killed more than 125 insurgents, but local tribesmen said it was a disaster for their communities and has made them leery of ever again assisting American or Iraqi forces. The battle, which pitted some Iraqi tribes against each other, talks about how complex it is. In interviews, influential tribal leaders and many residents of the remote border town said that the 1,000 U.S. troops who swept into their territories in the week-long campaign didn't distinguish between the Iraqis who supported the United States and the fighters battling it. So, thank you to JV, who said that Eastern Time is plus 5 GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. All right, we need to know that. This is, by the way, if you want to call in, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And Dan, who's writing from Livonia, who used to help out on the show. Hi, Dan. Haven't heard from you in a long time. He says, with all the problems we face nationally, it's almost too much to handle. I think we should we need to start here in Detroit and how Mayor Kilpatrick is running the city into the ground. I was just wondering what your thoughts were and if you had any solutions to help the city. Well, it's pretty complex. First off, Kilpatrick does seem like a disaster, and someone who, through numerous minor corruptions, is just not, I mean, it's obvious he's not going to be reelected. But the city is deteriorating because of larger economic forces. And in the wealthiest country in the world, just like so many other cities around the country, things are just going to hell. I mean, here, front page of the Detroit News and Free Press today. Teachers flee Michigan to find jobs. School openings are sparse here, so new graduates are forced to head south and west. Well, this isn't Kilpatrick's fault. I mean, get this guy out of here. I mean, he's more interested, he seems more interested in being a player and charging $800 dinners to the taxpayers. But the fact that the city is in debt for hundreds of millions of dollars just has to do with the whole state of where the money that this society produces goes. So almost all of it is just going increasingly to tax breaks. And so we're left with the, you know, we can't even hire the teachers we need. Or school computer gap grows. Proposed cuts hurt Michigan. This isn't Kilpatrick, but I think Michigan is required by the Constitution to have a balanced budget. So the governor has to make cuts somewhere or raise fees for colleges and what have you. And we, Michigan, are 43rd in the nation in students per computer. So I was going to talk about this. The Free Press had listed all of they through a Freedom of Information Act got a all these bills, these what do you call them, credit card bills that Mayor Kilpatrick had put together, and I mean it was just shameful, just absolutely shameful. But the idea that Kilpatrick has single-handedly begun to sink the city takes the focus off of the structural problems of both the city and also the the economy itself. All right, let's go to Mike in Westland. Mike, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Michael from Westland.
Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I wanted to know your thoughts and analysis and possible solutions regarding the impending failures of many corporations regarding their benefits and also their ability to repay their pensions.
Well, that's just another, I mean, that's crisis number, 212 that's occurred in the last 5 years. Yeah, all of us thought that, boy, particularly middle-class people thought, well, when I retire, I'll have a nice, safe and sound Social Security, and I'll have a nice pension, and there's no way that a big company is not going to pay a pension. Well, United Airlines has been able to slide out from under it. And then you find like a number of other local companies that have had worked people for 30 and 35 years, and suddenly they announce, well, we're not paying your medical anymore. And since there's no, disgracefully, no national health program, what are these people supposed to do? It's all going to go on Medicare. And Medicare is an authentic crisis, not like Social Security that's not in crisis in the slightest, not even an iota, not even a suggestion of a crisis. What are we going to do? Where is all this money that is produced in this country and all the hundreds of billions of dollars that we pay in taxes? Why aren't we getting the benefits of it? That's, I think, the central question. Okay, thank you very much. I thought maybe you had a comment as well, but we shall continue on and talk to Eric in Ann Arbor. Hi, Eric, it's Peter Werbe. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
How do you do?
I'm doing good.
Excellent.
Eric, turn your radio all the way off if you haven't.
Okay.
All right, good, because we're on this delay and you can't hear on the phones, I know.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on
the
air.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you very much for my call. And I've kind of been sitting on the fence since Bush was elected. And I want to thank you for your talk show and allowing me this opportunity. Basically, I don't understand, since I've been on the fence and I've been out of the loop of this whole political deal with Bush, I don't understand why he's cutting trees down when we can produce hemp. It provides the fiber, and we can make anything out of it. And the other part is, I don't understand when I do talk to conservatives or Democrats, excuse me, I don't understand why there's a negative connotation when we won a world war, when the government paid farmers to produce hemp to promote hemp for victory.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one, there are these prohibitionists and conservatives who always used to talk about getting government off your back, and authentic conservatives and libertarian conservatives realize that it's none of the political systems, none of the government, the executive branches. Business, how we, what we do with our consciousness or our bodies or what have you, and making criminals out of John Sinclair from Ann Arbor, where you're calling from, Eric, once said that he got put in sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in jail for smoking flowers. You know? So, yeah, there's a lot of commercial usage that hemp could perform, but you got to remember. Bush is all tied in with every mega corporation. One of the big corporations or industries is a forest extraction, as they call it, which means clear cutting the planetary heritage that should be guarded forever. Right? But what Bush is doing and what he's planning to do now is actually we wonder where our tax money goes. It goes to build logging roads that the companies cannot afford to pay themselves. And so the government, using our tax dollars, destroys this habitat and essentially gives off lumber, as beautiful trees are called when they're killed, for pennies on the dollar. And so, you know, you get, I don't know, maybe this guy Russ or somebody will call up and shred this lie. So that's why. So it's partly this Puritanism. With people that are getting in other people's business. I mean, what the hell business is of yours, of theirs, if you or anyone else smokes pot? It ain't any of their business. And certainly not to the point where you make people in our community criminals for wanting to do that. And the other thing is, as usual, and everything that is motivated through Bushco, through the machine, it's oriented towards helping big corporations make more profit at the common person's expense. That's what I say. Thank you. In fact, marijuana has become the focus of the drug war. No longer crack cocaine or heroin or anything like that. And in fact, the U.S. is upset because President Karzai, am I saying his name right? Because there's a friend of mine that has a name very similar. Yeah, it's Karzai. That's right. Isn't it somewhere here? Anyway, of Afghanistan, they say he's not doing enough. Now, under the Taliban, remember that Bush gave $42 million of our taxpayer dollars to Afghanistan, to the Taliban, in April of 2001, before 9/11. And that's because they had completely eradicated poppy growth and heroin base production and what have you. Well, now that the bad guys are out in the, what we think are the good guys, now they're growing heroin as the cash crop that they already always had. Well, it says here in the Washington Post, May 4th, so I've had this for a while. The focus of the drug war in the United States has shifted significantly over the past decade from hard drugs to marijuana, which now accounts for nearly half of all drug arrests, according to federal crime statistics. Study of FBI data found that the proportion of heroin and cocaine cases plummeted from 55% of all drug arrests in 1992 to less than 30% 10 years later. During the same period, marijuana arrests rose to 45% of the total. Coming in the wake of the focus on crack cocaine in the 1980s, it was accompanied by a dramatic rise in overall drug arrests from fewer than 1.1 million in 1990 to 1.5 million a decade later. Now, 700,000 marijuana arrests took place in 2002. 88% were for possession. And only one of every 18 of those arrests ended in a felony conviction. Yet, I mean, you talk about one of those. Where does our money go? Well, prosecuting 700,000 people, all the police time, all of the prosecutor's time, all of the judge's time to stop people from smoking flowers. U.S. prison population, already the largest in the world, reached a new high of more than 2.1 million last year, with one in every 38 residents of the country now behind bars. And you got to believe when you go into poor neighborhoods that even goes up more. So this is fairly insane, isn't it? U.S. federal prisons that house most drug offenders accounted for the largest increase of the drug prisoner population. Wow.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings, like Buddy's Pizza. Come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com. Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. We're here till 1 o'clock. And let's see, at 1, we're going to be airing an interview I did with Daphna Golan Agnan. She is she wrote a book about living in Jerusalem. It's called Next Year in Jerusalem. And just the pressures on people that live in that country with always the threat of violence. And she belongs she's a peace activist and wants to settle things in an equitable way between the Palestinian and Israeli people. And then probably around 1:30, it will be an interview with Martin Duberman, who has written a novel about the Haymarket Square incident. That was in 1886. Wow, I was like, wow, man, this would be a history lesson. Maybe a little. It's about when working people were demonstrating to get the 8-hour day, and the conservatives of that day, you got to remember, conservatives always want to conserve everything exactly as it is, no matter how rotten things are. Well, the conservatives at that time were, again, they were the factory owners and the businessmen, and their stooges, the politicians, enforced the idea that working day should be 10 hours, 12 hours, 16 hours even. And there was this great mass movement in the 1880s to bring about the 8-hour day. And the politicians, doing at the behest of the business owners, called out the police and shot workers down in the street because they were so radical that they only wanted to work 8 hours a day. All right, still was going to talk about my plan for world peace, but a lot of you have been waiting quite a while, so let's go back to those folks. Here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Paul, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Thanks, Peter.
Go ahead.
I wanted to make a point and probably put it out there for your listeners. I think that one of the failures over these last maybe decade or so was the voice of moderation and how crisis moves us from it.
Mm-hmm.
My belief really is that mass media broke its trust with the American voters when it stopped being a reasonable voice for moderation. My belief is that capitalism is a fine laboratory for what works, what doesn't, what needs to be fixed. But taken to the extreme, capitalism devalues life, and it makes unbridled avarice a virtue. But you have to understand, Stalin's communist socialist system might have killed more Russians than Hitler killed Jews.
Well, I don't know. Once you get up in the millions, that's what I was saying earlier, it's not even worth trying to balance. I mean, so many regimes of the 20th century were so hideous and so murderous.
Yeah, but it has to do with those extremes.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Well, I mean, ultimately, Stalin was both personality and the way he administered the system under his rule was no different than that of Hitler. I mean, the ultimate leader, people subjected to the dictates of the state, right?
Yes.
But anyways, but you're right. Unbridled capitalism, which is what Bush wants to go back to, was terrible for people and just ground down the lives. Talk about killing millions. Millions and millions of people had their lives virtually destroyed by working in unsafe conditions, no days off, all that stuff, 12, 16-hour days. And so if there's going to be capitalism, it needs to be heavily regulated, heavily policed, in my estimation.
But so does socialism. I mean, Social Security has worked, and it is a socialist type of system.
Well,
it has provided to take away a great deal of poor people that couldn't retire. You know, I mean,
right.
It eliminated that whole set of aged poor.
Yeah, it did, and that's what's so frightening to many people that are either, you know, anybody over 55 is safe. Well, if you can't go to the bank with this guy because they could change at any minute. But and as I said earlier, we should be talking about increasing Social Security benefits, not decreasing them. All right, thank you, Paul. Appreciate your input into it all. All right, let me real quickly tell you my solution. And you know what you're going to say? Wait a minute, that's not much of a solution. Everybody agrees with you. The first and the third. First one is make world peace instead of world war, the way Bush is going on. The third one is end poverty, and everybody would like to end poverty. People always have this idea that there ought to be more American aid, more United Nations aid. That's not what it's all about. That's charity, and that just kind of keeps people alive. And we have to have a restructuring of how wealth is distributed. Well, wait a minute, this guy wants to redistribute wealth. He wants to steal from people. Well, that's what's happening now. There's class war. There's this immense system of looting in place that keeps the vast majority of the world's population in poverty or at the edge of poverty. I mean, there's a lot of us, a lot of you that are listening, me, that are doing just fine. I mean, a lot of people listening that are, you know, kind of on the edge, and there's probably some people listening that aren't doing very well at all. But in the billions, there are people in the world which is awash in wealth in terms of its the total aggregate wealth of the world. And rather than using the wealth that is generated by all of the people to benefit all the people, it goes simply to secure the power of a small, teeny, select elite of the entire world to make all of the fundamental decisions. Oh, I know we can vote for Bush or Kerry or something like that, but those aren't the fundamental decision. The fundamental decision has to do with the quality of life. I mean, how can the average person, you and me, determine what goes on in terms of these overarching policies that are going to affect all of us with the environment or about war or about the economy, and we don't. We don't have any control over that whatsoever. So we can end poverty simply by stopping the looting. If you're calling in fact, if you're ringing right now, have a little patience. Our producer, Jay Hudson, will be to your call in just a half second. 313-298-WRIF. All right, the middle one is get off fossil fuels. That is extraordinarily crucial. So the three are make peace, not war, get off fossil fuels, and end poverty. The conservatives don't want any three of those because of what it entails, and also because most conservatives are just saps. I mean, they're chumps for the rich. They're their water boys. They're cannon fodder, and they're people that are really kind of infantile in a way that they can never break free of authority. So they always need these big father figures. They love people in power. They worship authority, and so. Even though the policies that almost always are enunciated by these big father figures are detrimental to them. But remember, the conservatives all throughout history always were against every change for the good. They never were. American Revolution, unions, women's vote, what was it we were just talking about earlier? Oh, yeah, the eight-hour day. The conservatives were all against the eight-hour day. Endlessly. They wanted to conserve segregation. They want to conserve discrimination against women. They want to conserve discrimination against gay people. So, they're really in the way of progress. But making peace. Now here, you have Air Force seeks Bush's approval for a space weapons program. They want to change what has always been these international treaties so the United States can start putting space weaponry, offensive and defensive. If you have an offensive and a defensive system, the defense system is just part of the offense system. So, and, you know, it seems to make some sense. Let's see. It says it must secure space to protect the nation from attack. Well, you know, who wants to be attacked? And you think, man, if we don't do it, maybe somebody else will. China, you know, really a rising, powerful, wealthy country. Who knows? Russia may get back to be our adversary again. Doesn't it make sense to control space? Well, if we maintain this hostile, competitive stance against these other countries. Now, I'm not talking, talking about terrorists or anything. These are psycho wacko. These are very conservatives. They're Muslim conservatives. So they're conservatives. They have a lot in common with our conservatives, actually. But what we have to do is to go on a program of peace seeking. And you can say, it never worked. Ever well, who knows? Never tried it. For one thing, the United States depends on a permanent war economy. Even with all of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal reforms, the economy never really came back till it went on to full-time war production in the first quarter of 1942. And when the war against Japan and the Nazis ended, there was this fear that we would go back to the Depression of the 30s. Well, lo and behold, we discovered another enemy, and we spent trillions of dollars, literally trillions of dollars, defending against this enemy that never, never intended an invasion or a, quote, conquering of the United States, and never even contemplated nor had war plans to invade Eastern Europe. This was pure fiction that justified these multi-trillion dollar expenditures on weapons, which were the basis. People, you have these conservatives talking about Keynesian economy. Keynesian economics, rather. Keynes said that in modern economies that the state had to take this private transfer of wealth, in other words, take our money that we earn and have the government spend it in a way to create motion within the economy. Pump priming, they called it. Well, that's what's going on now. So all of this money that's going to Halliburton and all these other firms that are taking our dollars, this is in part what they think generates a sound economy. Well, I mean, I don't think it really does, and it's a bad way to use it. I mean, if we wanted to actually follow that, which I support, again, not taking it from the middle class to the working class, we all deserve a tax break, but to take the money and use it for creating, someone said earlier about problems with Detroit, cure the problems of our economic system here. So then the wealthiest country in the world, we don't wind up with cities going into bankruptcy, that states having to cut back on services, that firing firemen. I mean, this is amazing. Where was this in the... Yeah, this was in the Detroit paper. The firefighters took out this huge full-page ad in the News of the Free Press. And I was shocked. They're talking about closing firehouses, laying off firemen, laying off fire inspectors. These are the guys that go around and say, hey, you've got all this stuff in the corner that's going to ignite and obliterate this place. That's all being cut as well. So, but the conservatives want to conserve things exactly as they are. Everything. Failing schools, failing cities, failing states, more and more poor people. That's what they want to conserve. And like a lot, I mean, there's a lot of wealthy people with conscience outside of Hollywood as well. And yet, these middle-class and working-class conservative men, that's about 90% of them, that, as I said earlier, base their view of politics on rage, on resentment, on prejudices. And so they wind up being the stooges for the wealthy. That's essentially it. So they're saps. They're suckers. And I was waiting for this guy to, since there's open lines at 313-298-WRIF, I was waiting for this guy to call. And what did he say? Shred me or something like that. And by the way, you can see all of this here. I mean, one of the reasons why, in fact, in a sense, the primary reason that Bush made up all these lies about weapons of mass destruction to invade Iraq. Here, this is from, I had this around for a long time. April 19th, the great engine of China is low on fuel. The great engine of China is low on fuel. So this is where you see this is a war for control of oil. So anticipating this great rival, China, we're going to take the oil of Iraq. Hey, what a great idea, man. We can blackmail them. We can make them jump through our hoops. Except this is what war is all about. Remember what finally sent Japan they knew a war was coming, but what the final stroke was that Roosevelt, cut off the strategic reserves of Japan. I can't even for sure remember what that even means, but they weren't fuel, but you can kind of get an idea just for the phrase. You don't even have to email me about it. I'll go look it up tomorrow myself. But in other words, Japan was denied the fuel it needed and said, well, okay, now we're going to go to war. We're taking the country to war. And then the next story I had in order is facing sanctions from the world because of its nuclear programs, Iran uses oil to seek allies. So who are they making up to? China. Right. So they're going to be buddies because they can provide the oil. Well, here is the mixture that is all but guaranteeing a war. I mean, this is a guarantee that this is going to happen. What's called resource wars. So what do we all do? If it's a small planet and getting smaller all the time, there's competition for scarce resources. Well, one of the things would be just the biggest and the toughest guy just grab what he can. So he said, cool, that's us. That's us, we can do it. Well, it never works for a long time. And what's necessary in order to maintain that status as the big boy on the block is bleeding this country dry, like every empire since Rome has been bled dry, whether it's Spain or the Portugal or England, that trying to maintain this empire across the world eventually destroys that country. All right. So that's the three things. Do I need to actually look at them? I guess I can't go yet. So make peace. We can do it. We got to just, for instance, complete nuclear disarmament, starting with us, because we can still get rid of about 8,500 nuclear weapons and have enough still to destroy the world. Be down to about 1,500 or something like that. But we have to begin to show these other countries that we're disarming. Because right now, countries like Iran and North Korea, the reason they want nukes is to forestall a U.S. invasion. I mean, they know if you don't have nukes or anything like that, you get invaded. If you do have them, you don't. So that's why they want them. They're not like crazy. Well, North Korea is kind of crazy. But like Iran's not filled with crazy people. It's people that kind of come from a whole different deck than I do. And I'm and they're worrisome to me. But it's not like they're going to attack the United States. They want to make sure the United States doesn't attack them. And which seems more probable? That Iran would attack the United States and get wiped off the map? Or that George Bush would attack Iran? All right, open lines if you're ringing now. Hold on, and Jay Hudson, our producer, will get your call. 313-298-WRIF. All right, we're just going to take the caller. It's been on the longest. It's Chris from Livonia. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for turning your radio off. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I just had a comment real quick, man. I just got out of the joint about a month and a half ago, and the main reason I think that the prison systems are so full still is because they don't have any rehabilitation. You go there... You're in there, you know, some of them go to school, some of them do, you know, duties around the prison yard, whatever, that's about it. When you get out, they don't help you try to find a job, they don't help you with anything.
Well, I know, you know, actually, you must be on a cell phone because it sounds, the call sounds pretty terrible. Yeah, well, it is it sounds like a cliche now, but they have it called the prison industrial system. And it's another way that the state creates jobs. I mean, so that there's construction for prisons, there's this huge number of people guarding people inside, and all the suppliers and what have you. And most of the people, well, not exclusively, but most of the people that go to prison are poor, and the next group up are the lower edges of the working class, and there's not jobs for them anyway. But, I mean, I agree with you that there should be. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, why isn't there job placement? I mean, we have the highest prison population per capita of any country in the world. Am I right? Or at least the Western industrial countries, but maybe even the world. So it's a system that has internal logic to it, but in the real world of really trying to, quote, stop crime, it's an utter miserable failure. As another thing, the conservatives want to conserve it just like it is. All right, thank you. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. We'll get Al from Inkster. Al, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. Turn your radio off, Al.
Yep.
Okay. We keep working with our engineers, figuring out why in the hell aren't we hearing, why can't the callers hear the show on hold? Yeah, go ahead.
I want to talk about, you know, the 8-hour day.
Yeah. What 8-hour day?
I know. They want, you know, they tell you, well, if you want to make more money, you know, work the overtime. And I'm like, I want to make enough money on 8 hours, you know, because... the Haymarket affair, you know, is 8 hours for work, 8 hours for play, 8 hours for sleep.
Right. Right. No, it's criminal that people are, in order to have a decent standard of living, have to work overtime. I agree.
Well, at $9 an hour to even have a standard of living, you have to work overtime.
Sure, sure. So we're back, and this is where Bush is, the 1880s.
The 1880s, and I was just talking to somebody from a union organizing group, and they're like, you know, we just have to forget that, you know, there were ever any labor laws, and if you're going to be a union activist and a union organizer, you're just going to have to assume that, you know, you're working like they did back then on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Completely radical, and, you know,
with no protection.
Well, every time, like in the 1880s, which is a big upsurge of labor, and then the 1930s as well, that ordinary working people were met by intense state violence. In other words, the state acting as the protective mechanism for the owners and the wealthy sent the police and National Guard out to kill hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Americans who were protesting for such radical things, as we were saying earlier, the eight-hour day or the right to, you know, to for union recognition. So I wonder what will happen this time around. I think probably the system is so wealthy that if we actually stood up and said, hey, we want, they'd probably say, okay, sure, just don't make a big commotion. Well, I hope so. All right, Al, thanks. Appreciate your call. Oh, yeah, I'm forgetting, been getting lots of email here. We were talking earlier about whether George Lucas's movie, the latest Star Wars, was a Bush parable. And people have made the point that, well, here, let me read you this from Marcus from Newport, Michigan. He wrote in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. Hi, Peter. I think it's rather interesting to note something regarding the parallels between the rise of the Galactic Empire and Star Wars and the Bush administration. Lucas did not deliberately create this parallel storyline as it was written before the first movie was ever released back in 77, but the fact that so many people are seeing the Emperor's rise to power in this fictional universe through war and fear and conniving schemes as a reflection of current policy and politics really says something about the danger posed by this administration. Well, I agree. On the other hand, I'm sure some of the dialogue was written in the 21st century, so very well both could be true. And we were talking about whether there was a comparison between Darth Vader and someone brought that up right at the beginning, between Darth Vader and George Bush. And Peter, who's listening in Tallahassee, says, somebody identifying themselves as a conservative said that they were a real Star Wars, what do you call those people, fans? But there's some other word for it. Anyway, a Trekkie. No, that's Star Trek, isn't it? Anyway, forgot what it is. Anyways, so he said it was about Hitler. And Peter from Tallahassee writes and says, well, that explains it. The Star Wars analogy is about Hitler coming to power. It's now perfectly clear why people are talking about the striking resemblance to George Bush. Whew. Right. Okay. Let's take another call here. It's from Charles in Wixom. Charles, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Star Wars situation.
Sure, please.
Yeah, I had seen an interview with Charlie Rose with George Lucas just a few days ago. It was a rerun, but he just completed the new film.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking, all the Star Wars movies are about myth, and myth is told to the young to express the values, the positive values of a society to the young.
Mm-hmm.
And he also discussed how our leaders, and at the time Bush and Kerry were going at it, he mentioned them, that he honestly feels that they're not learning from history.
They're not so, what?
They're not learning from history.
Oh, yeah, I'd say that's true.
Yeah, and also, I didn't realize it at the time, the first movie of this new trilogy, I believe, was actually making a comment on globalization, because there was a trade federation, and they eventually invaded a planet because of a trade dispute.
Well, I don't know whether it's Lucas himself, but certainly enough critics have said it appears to be the theme of globalization and the empire's attempt to control markets. And, hey, isn't that what so many wars are about? And as I just said a minute ago or so, all of this was conceived a long time ago, and I'm sure that there was pre-production probably in the late 90s for this and planning. But 5 years since the Bush administration gave George Lucas enough time to insert dialogue that could make those analogies between his administration and that in Star Wars very, very, very clear.
Well, I know that one other caller said he wrote out the outline about 30 years ago. And if you know anything about writing, 30 years ago is 30 years ago, and things change.
Sure.
So, yeah. So he doesn't really understand that. You know, I write a little bit, but nothing professional, but, you know, things do change.
They do indeed. I thank you for your call. Thanks for calling in. Let's see, we should do our commercials, but don't go away, because I think what I'm going to do first is Ken writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Ken is U.S. Navy retired. He says, it's totally about this government that is in power today. Oh, about Star Wars. Did you hear that the Christian fundamentalists have opened an evolution museum in Arkansas, and they state that Adam and Eve and the dinosaurs all lived at the same time in the Garden of Eden? And the dinos were wiped out by the flood, all but a couple that Noah put on his boat. So where are they? These people are really strange. I agree. Actually, I know somebody. Let me see. What's the name of the town that that's in? A friend of mine has a place right near them. I think we are headed back into the Dark Ages. Do you know that when religion ruled the world, they called it the Dark Ages? You know, it's not, wait a minute, you know, I don't think you're historically correct. The Dark Ages were because there were no great nations, there were no great men. People lived pretty decentralized, agrarian lives. And when the big nation states they formed, like France and what have you, that's when religion, always the handmaid of the state, sanctifying the state and its power and its however it rules, whether it's you know, totalitarian dictatorship in modern life, the way, you know, the Chilean bishops would sanctify Pinochet or any of the other Latin American dictators. And back in the Middle Ages, same thing. They were essentially handmaids of the powerful state. So the Dark Ages, where people kind of were left alone. We'll figure that one out. All right, right back.
This is WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys, announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. listening, WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back. I like this one. This from the Associated Press in Montgomery, Alabama. A pregnant student who was banned from graduation at her Roman Catholic high school announced her own name and walked across the stage anyway at the close of the program. Alicia Cosby's decision prompted cheers and applause Tuesday from many of her fellow students at St. Jude Educational Institute, but her mother and aunt were escorted out of the church by police after Cosby headed back to her seat. Said her mother, "I can't believe something like this is happening in 2005. Sheila Cosby said, "My daughter has been through a lot, and I'm proud of her." And so that's good. Good for her. I wanted to hear one of these stooges for the rich just wrote in. Mike from, actually doesn't even say where, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, how is someone who does not want to steal large percentages of what the, quote, rich earn and own being worshipful of authority? Now, I was saying that these conservatives, the cannon fodder, for the wealthy, they are worshipful of authority. They love authority. They love people in authority. And no matter how corrupt they may be, and that's why they make all these excuses for Bush and Tom DeLay and all these people. Anyways, get the language here. For one thing, he has "the rich" in quote marks. Like that, and he's not quoting anything. That's kind of misuse of the quote marks, but people do that kind of. It means like, there's almost not really the rich. Well, I'll tell you, Mike, there really is the rich, and the rich run everything. They make all the command decisions, the major decisions of this economy, and hence the political system. And democracy is kind of like a bad joke. They bought George W. Bush and the Republican Party because they know that these huge sums that they've lavished on him come back tenfold. And so he says he does not want to steal large percentages of what the rich earn and own. So, a lot of them don't earn it. They inherited it and what have you. But you're worshipful of authority because, that's what I said, you're advocating their advantage over the average American. The average American pays way too much taxes and gets so little back from it, whereas the average wealthy person pays so little taxes and gets so much back for it. And you are part of the ideological cannon fodder for these people that have destroyed democracy, number one, and number two, take the huge amount of wealth that comes out of the productivity of the American working person, whether you're in an office or a shop, and appropriates it for themselves. So they steal big time from the average American, yet you get guys like this. I mean, they're saps. I mean, they're people that would let insurance salesmen or encyclopedia salesmen into their house. And they say, well, you can't steal from them. They're stealing from us. We're just trying to make it a little fairer. All right, let's go back to our phones here. Where we got? Oh, yeah, we got Dan from Westland still talking about Star Wars. Good. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to start saying that. First, I am a conservative, and I do support Bush and everything. But on the whole Star Wars...
Wait, are you like some wealthy guy? I thought you were from Westland, or is it really from West Bloomfield or Grosse Pointe?
No, Westland, Westland County, but it's not the whole thing. The whole Star Wars thing, I've kind of noticed on that. One thing, I'm a big fan of Star Wars, and it seems like that, if I'm not mistaken, that George Lucas wrote the script for all these movies, so some 30 years ago.
No, he didn't write the script. He had all the ideas. This stuff is, all these conservatives are knocking Lucas because they're saying that he's this left-winger, and it's pretty clear that he purposely intended this to be a criticism of Bush.
I don't believe so, and absolutely, George Lucas, well, he makes some good movies. That's my opinion. But the whole thing is that why does the press and everybody else always try to politicize everything? It seems like, you know, oh, well, this is got me an attack on Bush. This is got me an attack on Bush. And it's like, why can't people just see for what it is, a really good movie or a really good video game? You know, just simple.
But it's because it's not that simple, and there are some very, very cogent points that Lucas is trying to make. And if you read any of his, I mean, Google, I don't know, what would you put in there? Just put Lucas Star Wars and see what you come up with, or, you know, do it in Yahoo. And you'll see all of the statements that he made. He's very critical of Bush, and this was, I would say, his intended. But if it wasn't, somebody made the point, people still see it as that.
Well, yeah, it's all caught up in this sensationalism of let's attack Bush. That's all you hear about nowadays. I've yet to hear anything good come out of the news. You know, it's like, well, good news, not going to sell any news.
Well, he got a free ride for a long time. I mean, what has Bush done that's any good?
Well, first off, I'd have to say that, you know, I personally think he's doing a good job in Iraq. I mean, yeah.
Wait. Didn't you read all this stuff where everything he said about Iraq was, let's be kind, incorrect? So we went to war unnecessarily.
Well, let me ask you this.
No. What about that? He said we had to go to war. Jay, grab line two, will you please? He said we had to go to war because Saddam Hussein had all of this weapons of mass destruction. Well, it turned out to not be the case at all. So why are we over there?
Well, do you honestly think you're going to hear about it on the news? You know, and I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, Black Hat came from us in the early 80s, came from Russia, France, and China, and Germany, which were, if I'm not mistaken, were primarily the opponents of us going there in the first place. Now, if I'm not mistaken on this, I think Bush made a good job by saying, hey, you know what, I'm not going to talk about this, because if I do, you know, I'm just asking to get my butt kicked, you know.
Wait a minute now. He, all of, every inspection group that it were supposed to report to Bush have come back and said there have been absolutely no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, come on, man. You're so far out in dreamland, and you, I mean, isn't it possible that even people you like have made, like, really bad mistakes? I mean, people I know, including me, and you must have as well. You make mistakes. Why can't you just say, look, the guy really blew it on this one? Because there were no weapons of mass destruction, period.
Well, I was hoping that you'd actually listen to my point of view, but it seems like you're just going to go and use it for an attack. But
No, wait a minute. Now, I asked you, what has Bush done that's good? And you tell me about this disaster of Iraq that was invaded for no purpose whatsoever, in terms of what he said, that we've already lost over 1,600 Americans, 12,000 Americans wounded, tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis killed, mostly the majority of them being children, and the country's being destroyed, and you tell me that's where he's doing a good job. Hey, are you, and I asked you too, are you rich?
No, I'm not.
Well, why would you back some guy who is solely a friend of the rich and has been attacking working people and our standard of living since he got in?
Because, honestly, I believe that, you know, that, once again, the news is just going to report bad news. They're not going to talk about the things we're actually doing for the Iraqis over there.
What are we doing for the Iraqis over there when the key thing is we're making a war in the middle of their country that was absolutely unnecessary, and we start getting now, you got thousands and thousands of Iraqis wanting us to leave. And the fact, if you go by the polls, the majority of Iraqis want us to withdraw now.
And let's see, and you're getting your information from the mainstream press, I'm assuming, right?
I get it from lots of different, but where do you get your information from?
I've had buddies over there. Okay, I've had friends over there in Iraq, and they fought over there, and they've all pretty much consistently told me the same thing, that yes, there's violence that pops up every, you know, area and whatever, but at the same time they're over there helping these kids out, you know, just paying out of their pockets to give these kids, you know, pencils and stuff for school. Then,
well, wait a minute, the reason that they when they help them is because the country has been destroyed by the U.S. war machine. right? That's what George Bush ordered in there to save us from Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. So on one hand, we're getting these, I was looking for this thing I was reading earlier, where the United States goes in, I was reading this. Thousands of Shiite Sunnis protest U.S. occupation. Clashes break out. The Shiites are asking to reject the U.S. occupation of Iraq by painting Israeli and American flags on the ground outside of Iraq to be stepped on in protest against holy places. Your buddies are from Michigan. What the hell are they doing 6,000 miles away giving kids pencils after they perhaps destroyed a village? Well, all right, hearing nothing, we'll move on. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. What more prime example could I have than of the what I was talking about? All right, here is, you'll have to say your name for me, please.
Six Tribe.
Six Tribe, okay. Didn't say it from Ann Arbor. Go ahead, Six Tribe.
Yeah, I was just listening to, first of all, let me tell you, I listen to you all the time and everything, and I was just listening to the guy a little bit ago who was talking about apparently how he doesn't agree that the allegories that are brought up in the new Lucas film and that Bush is getting a bad rep and everything, and I just wonder what country has he been living in for the last 4 years, you know? He's doing what a lot of young Republicans, in my opinion, and I'm neither Republican or Democratic or anything. I mean, I have my own personal political views, but it seems to me that a lot of young, especially young Republicans, are taking the point of view that I am a Republican, regardless of what the issues that are brought forth and how well the person that we've placed in office is doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that the facts speak for themselves, and the fact is that we went over there for a specific reason. We did not accomplish that task, and so we're going to stay over there until apparently people are sort of browbeaten to believing that we've done what we went there to do. You know, if we stay there long enough, maybe people will forget why we're there. But the bottom line is, we didn't find what we were looking for. Why don't we leave those people alone?
Well, I think that's a great idea. But one of the things you get from these folks is this clear view of the authoritarian personality. And they don't make the best citizens of democracy because, as I said, they worship power. And one thing is, you notice, if you ask a Republican, name some mistakes that George Bush has made. They'll come up with nothing. I mean, they will, even in the face of stuff like this. I mean, maybe Saddam Hussein took them all to Syria. You say, no, his own commission said that they don't think that occurred at all. Whereas if you ask any Democrat, did Bill Clinton make any mistakes? Well, they'll probably talk for the next 5 minutes about all the mistakes that he made. But when you have this aggressive personality, that's the outward face, but of conservatives and authoritarians, and inwardly you're this frightened little boy who needs a father figure. Well, you're not going to criticize your big father figure.
Absolutely. And I absolutely agree with the whole idea of the entity that is known as the rich existing in our society. And a lot of people don't really agree with that idea, but unless you've been on the opposite side of that, unless you've been a part of the group that has been the poor, or unless you are, extremely well educated and have had the opportunity to look at the people who you can consider the poor, then you it's hard to believe that there is an entity or this organization, and I don't even want to call it that, and it sounds conspiracy, and maybe it is, but there is an entity in the United States and probably in the world that is comprised of people who have way too much money and way too little as far as like moral and just general ideas about how to treat people, how to deal with people.
Well, of course, and you have wealth concentrated worldwide in such a manner that, I mean, I forgot, I was just kind of looking, I can't find it right here, but this amount of money that about 400, or I don't have it, let's call the lowest figure, four to 500 men control this enormous amount of wealth, and rather than it being used in general for the good of the planet. It is used just to enrich them and to bolster the kind of power that they have over the world. Well, if you look at the world today, in other words, if you I just talk about authoritarian father figures and the way these big, tough conservatives, tough-talking conservatives are really just these scared little boys inside and comes out. And they're afraid of their rage. They're, you know, they have all these fears about the world and all that. But if somebody ran a family the way the big father figures run this world or this country, we'd probably take the kids away. I mean, they're always fighting. There's, illness everywhere. There's intense poverty. In other words, child neglect for the citizens of the world. So the men that run this world with their incredible wealth that could change everything, in a matter of years if all this wealth was applied in a manner that benefited the entire planet and its inhabitants. And by that, I'm including everything and everybody in it. I can't remember where I started my sentence, but that could be done. And the conservatives want to conserve everything exactly the way it is today. They are a sad bunch. All right, thank you very much. Also, I'm going to have to leave a lot of you stranded because we got to do our commercials, then back with an interview, Daphna Golan-Agnon. I'm going to be talking with her live in Jerusalem.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy? A lot of squinting going on? Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up? Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R-E. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center. The most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877, you see more. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877, you see more. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com. Riff Rock. Rocks. Rocks. This is WRIF.com. We'll be right back.
www.riff.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. When most of us read about the situation in Israel-Palestine, I'm not sure what comes to mind. Unless you know the situation very intricately, it's very possible that many of you see it just like Northern Ireland, sort of an intractable problem, essentially cousins fighting one another or people fighting for the same land and neither side being really willing to compromise. But of course, like every situation, including Northern Ireland and the other places that we find great communal strife, the details are quite complex. Complex and nuanced, and also that people live in these different lands and they have a daily life. So I'm really pleased to bring to our microphones Daphna Golan Agnon. She's written a book called Next Year in Jerusalem, Everyday Life in a Divided Land. And Daphna Golan Agnon is joining us from her home in Jerusalem. Welcome to Detroit and the Peter Werby Show.
Hello, hi.
Yeah, now, that's true, though, that there is a daily life in Israel and in Palestine, and it's not all just troops and suicide bombings. And is daily life in Israel, for instance, a place packed with fear and constant violence?
Well, it's both packed with fear, but of course we also live our life. If you ask my children, they think about jazz and music and drumming and cinemas, and you know, we do have life here. We keep working and we keep falling in love and we keep hoping, but we also are frightened all the time. I mean, we're afraid to take buses. We go into cafes, but there's always a guard that checks us, and we, you know, we're never sure when the next bombing is going to happen.
Even though, of course, there's been a lull in them, there hasn't been one. And the bombs, they're not selective. It's not just who the Palestinians would view as the direct opponents of their desires. And anybody could wind up to be hit, including, I think there has been some notable peace activists that have been killed and injured. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were also Palestinian Israelis who were killed. Unfortunately, I think the despair of Palestinians is such that they act in a way that is not appropriate. But, yeah, anybody can be hit. And you're right, there is an opening. There's some window. I mean, we feel as if something might happen. But because we've lived through the Oslo Accords and we've noticed that, you know, when everybody was saying that the peace is coming, nothing really happened. And after the big hope, there was a big despair. So now I'm a bit more cautious about my optimism.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should tell people as well that you, Daphna Golan Agnon, teach human rights at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, where you live, that you're the co-founder
and research director of Betzalem. You'll have to correct my Hebrew if I'm not doing well. And the founding director of Bat Shalom as well. And so this would place you on the Israeli left, I mean, these organizations. But you actually come from a family, I guess I don't know if it's fair to say this, you correct me if I'm not, but a family with deep roots in the Israeli right wing. Am I correct?
Yeah, both my parents belong to the Lehi Underground, and what is called Stern Gang, that in the 40s fought the British and for Israel's independence, but were also very hostile to Arabs who lived here. And I really grew up believing that all this land is ours, that my father had a map of Greater Israel from Iraq to Egypt that he believed all belonged to us. But slowly, I looked around me and started asking questions and started wondering, why is it that we have all the privilege and all the rights and Palestinians don't? And I still actually don't have an answer for that. As many friends, Israelis and Palestinians, we believe that every person has the same rights and should have the same rights. And so we're working with, struggling together for a better Israel, a better Palestine, society that will be happy to live in and proud, and I think also will be a society of peace.
Tell us some about the organization, the paramilitary organization your father was in, the Stern Gang, because there is such horror, understandably so, and moral revulsion at terrorism on the part of Palestinians, yet the Stern Gang actually carried out a number of fairly horrific acts itself against the British.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that time they were the ones who chose to act in a military way, in a violent and what you'd call a terrorist way, against the British, because they wanted the British to leave Israel, Palestine, and they thought that the independence of Israel is more important than anything else. And in fact, the violence that very similar to the violence they use is what is used today by Palestinians fighting for their own independence.
Can you give us an example?
Well, my father was arrested. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail for trying to bomb a military train, a British train, which is a military target. Now, if you see what Palestinians were doing, were trying also to, in the ways that they could, first fight against the army with a stone. That was not very successful, but I think they're trying any way possible to say, hey, we also want to live in dignity. We also want to have rights. We want to choose our leaders. We want to educate our children. We want to be able to move. And in fact, they live, I think, a situation which is worse than the Jews live here in British Palestine, because they cannot move from one place to another. The whole West Bank and Gaza is filled with checkpoints, and just moving from one village to another is impossible. They cannot come into Jerusalem. The poverty is growing. There's a 50% unemployment. I mean, they really live a life of misery.
Mm-hmm. Some Israelis and some American Jews would say that's the fault of the Palestinians, that they were presented with this phrase we always hear in the States, a generous offer for a land of their own, and instead they began this armed insurrection, and everything that Israel is doing is in self-defense. And the Palestinians have only themselves to blame for their diminished position.
Well, I think the Palestinians missed some opportunities. I'm not saying they're not, but there was nothing given to them. In fact, in my book, I write about Ehud Barak, who was the Labor Party prime minister, who everybody claimed gave everything to Palestinians. And I'm citing him there in an article that he wrote, in which he said, I gave nothing to the Palestinians. I literally gave them nothing. There was not a single settlement that was discharged. There was not a single... in fact, what he did and what everybody kept doing is kept building on their land, on their territories. In the wonderful days of hope after the Oslo Accords, and in those days that Barak and the Israeli government were negotiating peace, they kept building, they kept putting checkpoints, they didn't release the prisoners, they didn't do anything to really say, hey, we really want to live in peace with you. But it was more of a surrender kind of, you know, you have to accept exactly our terms, or if you don't, we're not going to give you anything. And it's not a way to negotiate. It's not a way to negotiate future. It was not respectable. It didn't have any dignity. And I think we should do much better than that.
My guest is Daphna Golan Agnon, and her book is Next Year in Jerusalem, with the subtitle of Everyday Life in a Divided Land, and we're speaking to her in Jerusalem. The book is published by The New Press, available everywhere here in the States. As I always say, remember, check your independent bookseller first. And there will be a link on my website to the book. You mentioned that you came from a right-wing family. Your father was sentenced to 10 years in prison for attempting to bomb a military train. Did he serve a prison term?
No, he ran out of prison. We have here the central prison in Jerusalem has a permanent exhibition that shows how the 13 Jews escaped from prison, and he escaped after 6 years in prison. And in fact, a few months later, the state was declared. So he wouldn't have sat for 10 years, really.
Mm-hmm. And also, there's some famous, I'm not remembering all of my Israeli history, but there that the Stern Gang contained a number of fairly prominent men who went on to be leaders of the State of Israel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our Prime Minister Shamir was the leader of the Lehi. In fact, after the Likud government took over the Stern Gang, which was many years sort of on the very margins of Israeli society, suddenly became something that it's okay to say you belong to.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned a couple of times, I think it must be a Hebrew word that I'm not getting. What to describe the Stern Gang, is that, am I correct? Am
it's
I here?
Called Lehi. Lehi means the Group for Liberation of Israel.
Yeah, okay. And the Stern was the man who, what, founded it, or was the leader,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
When this must have brought a lot of strife within your family, that your father was a right-wing Israeli, and you were beginning to see that the Palestinians were living in a state not consistent with your values, or even what you saw as the values of Israel. Did that cause a lot of conflict within your family?
Yeah, well, in fact, unfortunately, my father died when I was 21, and a few months after he died, I moved into Jerusalem. And it was really in 1978 that I moved into Jerusalem that I started seeing things that I didn't see before, because I grew up in a small town, and what my parents told me seemed to be right, and what the teachers told me seemed to be right. And then I came to Jerusalem, and I started realizing that this city is very divided, that although everybody's telling us that this is a united Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish people forever and ever, there's not a single taxi driver that will take me to East Jerusalem.
Hmm.
So maybe something is not exactly as we're told.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I teach at the Hebrew University, which is on Mount Scopus. I was a student there, and just going there, we have to cross the whole city. And going from West Jerusalem to work in East Jerusalem to Mount Scopus, I just see every day that disparity between the two sides, and it's hard not to ask questions when you see the difference in between East and West Jerusalem.
You say it's hard not to, but do you feel that most Israelis do?
I think denial is a very tricky thing. I think people see and don't see at the same time. I think most people would say, as you've mentioned before, well, they deserve it. I mean, the Palestinians, they should work for themselves. They should do it for them. We shouldn't really do it for them. I think most Israelis don't know how bad the situation is. But also most Israelis know some. And I think any Israeli cannot say, I don't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know some, but you don't really want to know, or you don't care.
Well, it's kind of similar to the U.S. I mean, this is the industrial country with the largest percentage of people living in poverty, and I mean, in the tens of millions, and it's kind of, it doesn't raise, it's not raised the level of, you know, social awareness, and there's no social agenda about it. So it is easy to live amidst situations that on the face of it you would think that everyone would be directly confronting, and then not. My guest is Daphna Golan Agnan, and you're married to a novelist I'm familiar with and one of the country's most prominent novelists, S.Y. Agnan. Does he share your views?
Well, I'm married to his grandson.
His grandson?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
I don't know if it's an interesting question that everybody asked me with Agnan, who died some 15 years ago. Would he agree? I don't know. But his grandson, who's my husband, yeah, we share the same views. He also walked with me a long way. I mean, when we met, he was a soldier serving in Lebanon, and he also moved. His opinions also changed during the years that we're together. And especially raising children. You know, when you raise children in Jerusalem, there's so many questions that one asks herself or himself. You know, how do we explain to them the situation? What do we tell them when everybody's celebrating the unification of Jerusalem? I mean, what do we tell them when they want to go to school and be happy with everybody when they know that our Palestinian friends, it's the saddest day of their year for them. So raising kids and wanting them to be happy and wanting them to be good children, I mean, it's a good way to think about what's happening here.
Tell us some, on a personal note, how your views, which is concerned with human rights for the Palestinians and a fair and viable state for them, would you consider yourself politically isolated, or do you are a large minority or a majority of people sharing your views?
Well, today I'm very lucky because today most people think that way. Most Israelis understand. I mean, the polls show that 70% of Israelis are for a Palestinian state, believe that the roadmap or some kind of sharing like this is the only way, that there'll be two states, Palestine and Israel. So today I feel very lucky. But of course there were years when people thought that I'm completely crazy. There were years that it was illegal for us to talk to Palestinians, that we couldn't meet them, that we had to go to Europe to academic conferences to meet our friends who live 10 minutes away from us. So this has changed. I mean, it's a very interesting process that happened in Israel, where even Ariel Sharon, who we consider a right wing, I mean, who is responsible for most of the building of the settlements, even him, he is now saying end the occupation. There should be a Palestinian state. So the conscience has changed dramatically in Israel.
No, I was going to say, even I believe it might even be on the bet. I'm losing my my little ability to pronounce it. Betzalem, is that good enough?
It's very good. Betzalem, yeah.
Betzalem. On the website, or one of the Israeli peace groups, it shows a map of what the West Bank would look like under the Sharon plan, and it doesn't show the implication is that there's not a basis for a viable Palestinian state. There's a huge, you know, that wall that's up, this huge road that would be for Israelis only, the claim by many critics is that Sharon's Palestinian state is really just a charade.
Yeah, well, I think it's true. I think that first of all, we don't exactly know what's his plan. I think he never came up with a clear map, which I think, you know, when you negotiate the future of our country, the people should know what the borders are going to look like. I mean, it's not something that we should be surprised with. I don't think I personally don't believe that he really wants to uproot most of the settlers. And the way it is, it looks like what the Palestinians call the Swiss cheese, where they have the holes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's they from going to one place to another, there's no way for them to go unless there are bridges that will be built or tunnels that will be built. And in fact, I just came back from a travel in the West Bank right now, and it's quite sad to see the Israelis are going on the upper road and the Palestinians going on the roads that are down there. I mean, it sounds almost crazy, but that's the way it is. There are roads for Israelis and roads for Palestinians. I mean, this cannot work, really.
Well, Daphne Golan-Agnon, you were in the Israeli army. You were an officer, and you said your husband served in the army, as most Israelis do, men and women. And we're coming to a critical point where there's supposed to be withdrawal of all Israeli settlements for the Golan Heights, where there's several thousand Israelis, settlers, and a million Palestinians. So even Ariel Sharon, the great expansionist, realizes that's an untenable position. And there's been talk of close to civil war. The right wing settlers who with along with the Stern Gang we mentioned earlier have a long history of violence and attempting to settle things through violent means. Is there a fear, or in general, or do you hold a fear that a lot this could develop into violence between Israelis?
No, I'm not so afraid. I hear our prime minister saying it for the last few weeks. Every week he's saying we're close to a war, internal war. And I think he's exaggerating. I think that all the soldiers who do not want to be there, who do not want to help the disengagement, shouldn't be there. I support their right to refuse to do something that's against their conscience. And I think they shouldn't be forced to do it. But there's so many others. I mean, the settlers are a small minority, and such a small minority that most of us want them really to get out, because we don't want to keep paying the price for them to be there in the midst of more than a million Palestinians. And so I think there's such a huge majority against them that, I mean, the only thing that's left for them to do is to make a lot of noise now, and I understand them. I regret that that's the way it's going to happen, but, you know, it might be a little unpleasant for a few days, and I'm sure for most of them it is a tragic event. But I think it's a price that we have to pay for our future.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the West Bank? I mean, certainly there's long-established settlements that are in the West Bank. I mean, all international law and UN resolutions say that you can't, a conquering nation can't establish or can't annex territory. So it's the spoils of war. Yet I don't think there's any intent to leave the majority of sections of the West Bank, is there?
No, I don't think there is an intent. I mean, I think that the best thing would be just to leave them there, really, to withdraw our army, to say this is our border, enough, we're an independent state, we have to have a border, this is our border, whoever wants to stay in the Palestinian state, let them stay there. It's fine with me, really. And I think I'm serious about it. I think there should be some kind of an agreement with the Palestinians. We in Israel, there are Palestinians living in Israel who are citizens of Israel. There might be Jews living in the Palestinian state. I think it's fine.
Yeah, well, that does make some sense. I don't know. We could see how that would fly. Let me see. We only have, about 3 minutes left. And I did want to get some to you. You mentioned earlier about the terrible conditions Palestinians live under. But it's not just poverty. I mean, it's shocking to many people that see the details of the way the Israeli army has acted in the occupied territories, the state of some of the prisons. And that's what B'Tselem takes on, of the organization, the human rights group of which you were a co-founder. Is there any change in that? I mean, people are often are shocked because they see historically Jews have been the object of so much terror and oppression and mass murder and torture that when we hear tales of this, it's very confounding.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's sad. I mean, the sad part is that I don't think anybody can have a military occupation for almost 40 years and be really protecting human rights. I mean, it's just impossible. What the Israeli army is doing in the occupied territories is really, I mean, it's really terrible. There are things that I can say that there's some improvement in some little aspects after reports that we've written or an outcry that came. For example, when we first started our organization, there was mass torture in prisons. I mean, we documented this daily torture of Palestinians in prisons, and for years we published reports and we published press releases, and it didn't stop until finally the Israeli High Court ruled that it's illegal. So I'm not saying there's no more torture in Israeli prisons, but there's much less than before. At least people understand that it's illegal, or people feel a bit uneasy about it. It's not a daily routine. So, yeah, I mean, things have changed a little bit, but the reality is still a very shocking reality.
Mm. You only have about 30 seconds. This is probably a complicated question. Given still the dangers that remain and what you said about being fearful, do you ever think of leaving? I mean, there's strong Jewish communities all over the world, including here in Detroit. Any thought?
No, you should help us. You should help us here in Jerusalem. You should help us live here. I want to live here. This is my home. I love Jerusalem. I want my children to be happy here. And I hope that our next year in Jerusalem will be a happier year with your help. I mean, you should think about us in a different way and find ways to support the Israeli peace movement.
Well, you certainly make that point very clear in your book, Next Year in Jerusalem, Everyday Life in a Divided Land. And I will have some links also to B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Human Rights and Peace Group, so that people that are interested can take up Daphna Golan Agnan's call for us to help. Thank you so much for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This is WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Kambadi is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877, you see more. How good is Dr. Kambadi? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877, you see more. Dr. Kambadi is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full
price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. You know, I think I've said before, I always find it really tough to interview people about novels because they have a storyline. You don't want to give away things. Usually this is a program about issues and ideas, but so is this particular novel. It's actually available now in paper. It was a hardcover edition. It's been published by Seven Stories Press, and it's Haymarket, a novel by Martin Duberman. And Martin Duberman lives in New York City where he was born. He's currently a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York and founder of the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies. That's the first such research center in the world. He's also a renowned labor historian and activist and is the author of over 20 books. I think that's him coughing there. Martin Duberman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. I was trying to conceal the cough, but you know, I didn't succeed, and I may do it again.
Well, here's the bad news. We don't edit around here, so it's just like a live broadcast.
That's okay.
Well, thanks for joining us. Congratulations on the novel, the novelization of this historic night of May 4th, 1886, at least where it begins in Chicago's Haymarket Square. This, maybe you could bring us just up to speed on the details for people that don't know what the Haymarket incident was.
Yes, what it was in essence was an outdoor protest meeting, because earlier there had been a strike had been broken up at the McCormick Reaper Works outside of Chicago, a strike which the workers felt had been broken up very brutally by the police, with a score of workers killed and injured. So this was a protest called for that reason, and it was a protest that had a disappointing turnout from the point of view of the organizers. And it sort of, you know, wandered along in the course of the evening. The crowd became increasingly dispirited and began to trickle away. And in fact, they were winding up. The last speaker was on the platform. At that point, and you might want me to stop here because I don't want to give away the punchline in advance.
Well, no, go ahead, because this I think this is a key component of it, and some of what I wanted to ask you about.
Okay. Yeah. At that point, as the meeting was all but over, a sizable contingent of police arrived, some on horseback, and they very forcibly broke up the crowd. At some point, as this was going on, there was a sizzling sound overhead, which turned out to be a bomb. And the bomb exploded right in front of the police ranks, killing one officer outright, wounding some half dozen others. No one knows to this day for sure who threw that bomb, and theories have ranged from a police agent provocateur to one of the anarchist protesters. But in any case, that caused the police to use even more force. In fact, they struck out violently at the remaining crowd, and people scattered in all directions. The so-called riot was over in a matter of minutes, but there were a significant number of people hurt. We'll never know how many, because a lot of the workers who had gathered to protest, who were wounded, were dragged by friends and relatives immediately down the side streets to get them away from the police.
A lot of the figures, though, many were killed, though, weren't they? And also maybe as many as 200 wounded. Sounds like Uzbekistan, what we're reading about now.
Well, yeah, there is a real parallel there.
Yeah, well, Martin Duberman, so this is history. It's available through historical accounts, probably not real well known. Why the novel form?
Second cough. I hope it didn't register.
That's okay. What?
I'm sorry. It prevented me from hearing your question.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the history is available in many history books. Why did Martin Duberman choose the novel form to present it? You have lots of other history books that are conventional histories, in the conventional history form.
Right. For me, the problem with the historical record, which incidentally I have tried to stick to very carefully, but what's lacking in that record is the kind of intimate subjective information about the inner lives and the relationships of the main figures involved in this historical episode. And as someone who has also written plays, I've long been frustrated as a historian by the fact that we can describe often very well outward behavior, but we cannot, that is, we stick to our scruples, we cannot describe the workings of the interior life. And that has long interested me, so I decided, what the hell? Though I've written plays, I had never written a novel, but I thought, I will use the shards of evidence that do exist about these inner lives in order to much more fully recreate than is usually possible dramatic figures for a historical narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me this, just when you just open up your novel, Haymarket, It's set in spring 1871, Johnson County, Texas, and you begin talking about Lucy Gonzalez, who becomes Lucy Parsons, the wife of one of the executed people executed, which is I'm leaping ahead of the story for which was one of the scapegoats for this incident in 1886. And so you, the first three paragraphs describes her duties. How does one assemble all of that? I mean, what was the I mean, is this completely out of your head, or what? I mean, how do you put it together?
Well, first of all, you read as widely as you know you can in surrounding materials like the history of Chicago, the history of daily life in late 19th century America, and so forth, in order to try to get as good a feel as possible for the period, for what kinds, even down to what kinds of utensils people used in their kitchens in those years. And out of that, you know, assembled mass of information, you pick and choose, and you yourself very rarely understand why it is that you've decided to open a book with this particular scene, or in that scene you've decided to focus, you know, on a particular exchange between some of the characters. That's all part of the mysterious process that makes one novelist different from another, I suppose.
Now, speaking about difference, though, and this is, I'm kind of skipping all over the place, but you have written over 20 books. You're also the founder of the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies. You have written books about the great African-American Paul Robeson, about a play, Visions of Kerouac, about the Beat Generation, and a variety of subjects. Is there any link, or is this just an expansive interest in the human experience, or both?
I think there's a very definite link, and that is my fascination with the world of outsiders.
Mm.
And that could mean people who are in the minority in terms of race or class or sexual orientation or gender or any number of things. But that is, I would say, the focus of my work in general.
Okay, let's go back to the Haymarket incident, which you chronicle in your novel called Haymarket. There is a riot or a police attack, however you'd like to characterize it, on May 4th, 1886. Civilians are killed, police are killed, 200 civilians wounded. And how does the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois react?
They react primarily with indignation against the working class. What we have just before the riot is a workers' movement that went by various names over, say, a 20-year period, but which was, you know, mounting in terms of membership and influence and potential power. And the powers that be had been getting more and more nervous about, you know, the have-nots suddenly finding their voice and making demands. And certain elements in the ruling class were determined to silence that voice, if at all possible and convenient. Excuse me, another cough coming.
That's all right. I think this will be a good time for me. I just kind of turned his microphone off, and I can tell you that we're talking with Martin Duberman, and he's the author of Haymarket. It's just now available in paper. It's published by Seven Stories Press, and it's the dramatization of this 1886 incident between strikers and the Chicago police that has a lot of ramifications for the period and some suggestions for today. And I forgive Martin Duberman for coughing like that, because all of us have been struck with this almost plague of cold and coughs, including yours truly.
Mine's been going on for 4 months. It
wow.
comes and goes. I can't get rid of it.
Well, I came back.
Anyway.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's up to you. Whatever your next question
okay.
might be.
And I was asking about the reaction. You said of indignation, and essentially this
yeah.
was a part, and if I'm correct, this was the origins of Workers' Holiday of May Day, and it was about trying to get the eight-hour day established as the working norm from what it had been up to that time.
Yes, that that was the big slogan during that period of organizing in the latter part of the 19th century. It's very hard for us today to understand just how appalling working conditions in general were in this country. We associate a lot of the reforms that we currently have, though they're being whittled away, with legislation which in fact was passed only in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt was president as part of the New Deal. We no longer remember, at least most people don't, that before there was anything like workmen's compensation, say, or Social Security, or even rules for providing safety in factories, that most workers worked under appalling conditions, very long hours, sometimes 18-hour days, very low salaries. If they were injured on the job, well, tough luck.
Mm-hmm.
They were out of work. There was no compensation. It's very hard for us to understand now. But as I said, there was increasingly a determination on the part of the workers themselves to improve the conditions of their daily life. And they finally learned the lesson that we've all learned, that in order to make social change, you have to band together and organize.
Mm-hmm. Something that's becoming more and more difficult, but maybe we can talk about that a little later. Mm-hmm. You know, I received so many books, and I remember seeing this and always having been interested in that that incident at Haymarket Square in Chicago. In fact, having I took part in the centenary, the 100th anniversary of Haymarket in Chicago in 1986. And we visited the location, which is now right by one of the freeways. There was a statue erected. Do you know that story, or should, about the
blowing up of the statue?
Well, yeah, and the statue, the citizenry took up a subscription. The upper class did to commemorate the police that were killed. Maybe you could continue from there.
Well, you probably know more about that aspect of it than I do, but what I do know is that, you know, there was a statue of a heroic policeman, and it was long resented by working class people in Chicago, and eventually, I can't give you the year, it was blown up. My understanding is it's since been replaced.
Okay, well, maybe here I'll quickly tell you, because I want to get back to your field of expertise and your novel, Martin Duberman, Haymarket. You're listening to Peter Werby's show, by the way. In like 1912, a union streetcar driver took his streetcar off the tracks and knocked it off its pedestal. It was returned. Then the Weather Underground blew it up like in 1970.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And then they replaced it and they blew it up again. And it was finally put inside of a precinct quarters, you know, with fencing around it. And just recently, the Illinois Historical Society and the police and the labor movement, now as it stands now, put kind of an amorphous statue that they could all agree on.
I see.
Okay, that's my
history. In other words, a statue that says nothing and commemorates nothing.
Right, all right. Yeah. That's my history. Back to Martin Duberman's history. Let me tell you what, oddly enough, what motivated me to invite you on the show, besides the strength of your novelization of this, and that was your review of the history of John Brown, the abolitionist who attacked Harper's Ferry in 1859. And it was what interested me was your discourse on violence and when it's appropriate. That was in the Nation magazine of May 23rd. So we're looking at a 19th century that was extraordinarily violent. What any sense as a historian why would a country go through this, or was this kind of average for countries?
Well, I don't know that you know, the late 19th century was any more violent than what we're currently seeing today. Less of it may be happening here in our own country, and certainly not in terms of, you know, class resentment or workers versus owners. But we're seeing a vast amount of violence being conducted in our name outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you then, we'll go back a little to Haymarket. You know, I forgot to ask you before we went on the air with this. Do you have a copy of the book close to you that you could I could get you to read a little section?
I don't, as a matter of fact. I can get one if you like.
But... How long? Because I'm telling you, we don't edit this, so it's got to be 30 seconds while I go, while I run through.
Well, we probably have enough. My guess is we have enough to talk about. So.
Okay, all right.
Want me to read, I'd be glad to.
I would like to, because the language, I mean, just opening it up, and it's, novels today they almost read like scripts or like scenarios for movies. There's so little to them. I mean, they don't seem to be informed with any poetic or descriptive sense of what they're describing and trying to make real. And it's just sort of driven by dialogue solely, whereas there's dialogue in this.
Did you have a particular page in mind, or random choosing would be difficult?
I don't know. Do you have a favorite little spot in his, or...
Lord, I did a number of readings when it came out in hardcover 2 years ago, but I don't have a marked copy.
Do you have it with you?
Yeah, I do have it.
You know what? I think the first three paragraphs of the book on page three are excellent. I mean, I was impressed both by what was described, the use of language, the little peek into 19th century life.
Okay, sure.
All right, so this opens the book, Haymarket, by Martin Duberman.
To watch 18-year-old Lucy Eldine Gonzalez cross the room, her step stately and purposeful, her red twill dress rustling dramatically, to see her move was to know at once that she wouldn't take kindly to having her time wasted with quavering inquiries about how long... to boil the lye and grease scraps for soap, or whether the missing cowpuncher ought to be searched for in town and given the $2 more a month it demanded, or just let disappear, since he knew as much about cattle as a hog does about a side saddle. Lucy had to deal with such questions, had to deal with them over and over again, as the woman who ran her uncle's small Buffalo Creek ranch. Which was why she insisted the questions be short and her answers even shorter. Most of her waking hours were spent feeding the chickens and razorback hogs, pouring candles and knitting socks, making sure the hired hands kept the vegetable rows weeded, the wheat fields tended, the stake and rail fence in repair, and overseeing the two Mexican women in the repetitive round of household chores. But Lucy felt alive, not when cleaning out the air shopper or cooling a prairie chicken in the creek, but when, finally alone in her room at night, she could pore over the New Orleans Tribune, read the reports of the latest measures being proposed by the radical Republicans in Congress to curtail the latest atrocities. A 10-year-old Negro boy castrated and cauterized, made to live. A white woman, rumored to be giving her favors to black men, dragged from her home, hot tar poured into her vagina.
Now, thank you. And I forgot about the ghastly end to the third chapter. My guest reading from his novel Haymarket is Martin Duberman. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I mean, one might say, you could type that out in 20 minutes on a computer. But what is laden in there, and must just in that those first three opening paragraphs must have taken an enormous amount of research.
It did, in fact, yeah.
Yeah, and those atrocities, when we talk about radical Republicans, maybe that's a necessary explanation now, because we often have the Republicans called in Congress today radicals, but this is a different breed of Republicans, right?
A very different breed indeed. Radical Republicans in the post-Civil War period were those white men in Congress, and that there only were white men. Once in a while later, a single exception here and there, those white men who felt that the ending of slavery was not enough, that what was now needed was to stabilize the conditions in which the freed ex-slaves found themselves, to find ways to protect them from the anger and brutality of their previous masters, and to also begin to get them at least the rudiments of education and some kind of stable job occupation.
Now, when you say that the soon-to-be Lucy Parsons in the beginning of Haymarket, you're saying she read the New York, or rather the New Orleans Tribune. I assume that these atrocities that you mention here, were actually in that paper.
I can't swear to that. I know the atrocities were real.
Mm-hmm.
I may have learned about one or several of them from a variety of sources, not simply from the New Orleans paper.
Okay. Now, and this.
But they happened. They were real.
You've been very tolerant of me skipping all over the place, and we only have a couple of minutes left. We are not going to get the conclusion, because you don't do that with novels, of what occurs in Haymarket following this horrendous riot in Chicago's Haymarket Square. But the kind of standard boilerplate question is: this just of historical interest, or that what's coming? Is there a lesson for today?
Yes. There is indeed a lesson.
What's that?
At least the way I read the episode, and that is that once this riot took place, the powers that be used it as a way of breaking apart and destroying what had been a mounting movement of social protest against current working conditions. What the authorities in Chicago did was they rounded up everybody who had even a remotely leadership position in even the most moderate of trade union organizations. Hundreds of people were jailed, and in the upshot, a number of men were hanged from the gallows, including Lucy Parsons' husband, Albert Parsons, who had turned himself in voluntarily. The police had not been able to find him and arrest him, but rather than let his comrades go to prison and ultimately the gallows without him, he went and turned himself into the police. Even though at the time the Haymarket riot took place, Albert Parsons had already spoken and had gone off with his family to wait for friends at a nearby cafe. In other words, he wasn't even present.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this man lost his life on the gallows. He lost it following, and there's no time for detail here, but he lost it following what almost all legal scholars now agree is one of the biggest sham trials in all of American history. The presiding judge, for example, would invite up the society matrons and young women who attended the trial on a daily basis as a kind of circus entertainment. He would invite them up to sit with him on the bench, and they would do puzzles together and chat and laugh, even while testimony was going on in the witness box. I mean, it was a trial of such scandalous proportions that it's literally hard to read. And of course, I read the entire transcript of the court proceedings, which do very much exist.
You know, Martin Duberman, we're going to have to leave it at that. And in fact, it's a cliffhanger. You'll have to read the rest of it. Haymarket, it's a novel by Martin Duberman. And Peter Frank of the Washington Post says, Haymarket is a spirited, fictional reconstruction of the police-instigated Haymarket Square riot in Chicago in 1886. You can go to my website, peterwerbe.com, PeterWerbe.com. You can link on to the book, and also Martin Duberman for all his other works as well. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to WRIF.com. every day. Employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds family.